Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Mischief Makers, your one-stop shop for all things mischief. Join your host, Dave Hearn, as he finds out what makes mischief, well, mischief.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mischief Makers. I'm Charlie Russell, and today I have the honour and pleasure of interviewing the disgustingly talented Ishani Perinpanayagam. Hello, hello, Ishani.
Hello.
So for those of you that don't know, this is a podcast for people to get to know the members of Mischief and just generally find out interesting things about some very interesting people. So Ishani, the first section of this interview is called the Getting to Know You section. Now, it's become a bit of a thing where we don't actually have jingles, but instead we ask our guests to improvise some, and I know you can do that. You're both an improviser and musical, Ishani. So I would like you to improvise a jingle for the Getting to Know You section. Are you ready?
Yes.
Off you go. Great.
Getting to know you. Who? Getting to know you. Let's see who you are, getting to know you.
Oh, that's lovely.
Thanks. I mean, that's very kind.
I really enjoyed that. That's much better than mine. I think I went very low when I was interviewed. Very low, too low. Now, Ishani, I am very excited to interview you today. This is so exciting.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Honored.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, of course we're interviewing you. We first met back in 2018, I think it was. But it feels like not long ago.
No, but it feels like longer than that.
Yeah, like I feel like I've known you longer than that, which in a nice way.
Yes.
And I think we were rehearsing for the tour of Mischief Movie Night, weren't we? I particularly remember getting to know you in Leicester. We had a lovely time.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I think those weeks were quite intense, weren't they? And they were quite sort of, they were quite intimate in that they were, yeah, you were all, everyone was flung together and, made to make up stuff and it all turned out to be wonderful. So it just felt, yeah, it was wonderful. We had a lovely time.
Really, I had a really good time on that tour. It was very special. And you're right, like we did sort of, it was really intense and really lovely, wasn't it? And you're an incredible person, obviously. But I want the listeners, our Mischief fans, to get to know you. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. So Ishani, tell us, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Ealing in West London. And I stayed in the same house, actually, for the whole first 18 years of my life. So
wow.
Very boring. Very boring story. That's where I grew up.
Well, that's quite interesting to me. I think I lived in about 5 houses before I was 18.
You?
So to me, I find that a very interesting fact.
Ah. Yeah, I suppose. So before I was born, my parents and my sister moved around a lot because of parents' work just within the UK, although having come from Sri Lanka in the first place. So I guess I noticed the stark contrast of sort of them saying, oh, when we were in this house or that house. And so my timeline is very different And there's it's sort of a big block of primary colour, which is cool. It was a lovely place to grow up. And I was a nerd. I quite loved school.
I was going to say, where did you go to school and how did you find it? But clearly you loved it.
I did love it. I just went to a primary school that was actually a bit of a way away. So I didn't, a bit of a way away in terms of like 2 miles rather than walking up the road. And it sort of meant I didn't have that childhood where I popped around to people's houses, which I believe other people did. But I really enjoyed school itself. I enjoyed all the learning, I suppose, but also football. I was really into football, mostly because I was quite competitive. Yeah, but it was mostly because I was competitive and fearless. So I just used to get the ball and run at people and they would move.
I mean, that's a great tactic. I clearly did not employ that enough.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It translated when I went to high school. It translated really briefly to hockey until I just got too small and I just bounce off people when everyone else threw. Because... And that was the end.
Well, yeah, because now, you know, if you're listening to this, you won't know, but Ishani is quite a petite lady. Quite small.
Yeah. Really? Yeah.
How tall are you?
5'2".
Oh, I mean, you're not like, you know.
No.
I don't want to be disparaging about anyone who's smaller than 5'2". But that in my household is very normal.
I've got a very short upper body. So I look shorter than I am as well. When I sit down, I vanish, essentially. But
when you play the piano.
Yeah, it's not. I would like to think I'm not much of a diva, but... whenever I get to a new piano, piano still height's really important to me because I need to be able to reach the keys and, if I'm music directing, see over the top. So I come across as a diva of like, can I have a cushion, please? Because it just isn't the right height. And the thing is because my hands are really small, if my arms aren't level, I can't stretch as far as I need to be able to for like most piano music. So if my wrists at a funny angle, my hands end up even smaller than they are.
Wow. This is fascinating. So,
are you sure?
Yeah, this is really fascinating to me. So this leads me into my next question. I wrote on Twitter, you know, you're a pianist amongst many things, but you're a classical pianist. So what point did you get into music and the piano?
Well, again, it was quite a long shape rather than I didn't have one of those moments of ting, yes, now this definitely. I started playing the piano when I was really little, and apparently I had this toy piano that I just wouldn't put down, and I was just playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star over and over again really badly. My parents, who weren't musicians, were just sort of looking at it and listening to it going, I think she's going to do that over and over again. We should probably get her to some lessons before she can't undo all the bad things she's doing. So I started going to lessons when I was reasonably little. And because I really enjoyed it, I suppose it started off being not a competitive thing, but I really enjoyed being able to play loud and fast. I just love being able to play loud and fast, which I guess when I hit teen years, it gradually became something more meaningful of I liked being able to play loud and fast and angsty, and then it became slow and angsty, and then it became, oh, I think music might be really important to me. So I think I always the piano was always at the core of my life somehow, but it didn't shift into being something more meaningful until maybe actually when I was kind of 13, 14. And then I had a piano teacher that said to me, I mean, you know you're not going to be a pianist, right? You know you're not good enough. And I sort of went, oh, and that totally destroyed me for a couple of years. And I suppose probably through that misery was the moment where I went, this is what I want to do. But it was probably in the past tense of this is what I wanted to do.
And this person stopped me and now I'm going to not let them stop me anymore.
Oh, I wish it was that. It was more, oh, I didn't realise I really wanted to do it. Although I did realise, it was more like, oh, I wish I was good enough to do that thing. It's sadly a more sad tale. I wonder, looking back, whether she was trying to put a fire up me to make me go, I can do it. But actually I went, oh, if you say I'm terrible, then I suppose I'm terrible.
I mean, that is a risky game with children to be like, you're rubbish. Because I think most kids just go, oh, okay, I'm rubbish. Like, it's only occasionally does it work, that sort of reverse psychology thing.
Yeah.
But you realised you wanted to do it and then you went and trained?
Yeah, so I went to music college and, yeah, I studied at two different places, one for undergraduate and one for postgraduate. And so I did 4 years at the Royal College of Music and then 3 years at the Guildhall. And my last year, my head of music said to me, so I was basically, I'd meant to stay for 1 year every time for postgrad, but they had kept saying, we don't think you should leave yet, stay. We don't think you've got what everything you need out of this yet. So they suggested I stay and I stayed. And my last year they said, we think you might work quite well playing with other people. Stay and do the accompanist course, which I did. And that I suppose, that was the moment this is what I'm supposed to do. Because actually, despite me saying when I was little, all this business about loud and fast, I'm not actually that built to play loud and fast, but I think I probably am built to listen and respond.
Mm.
So actually, it was quite a lot of training before I realised the thing or the kind of area I was supposed to be creating in.
Mm. Do you think, I mean, when those teachers were saying stay and do another year, was that in the same vein as that piano teacher you had, or was it in a much more supportive way?
It was supportive in quite a roundabout way. It was maybe a little bit after my final exam, you should probably stay and do this more. So it was kind of a mixed bag. But I mean, I suppose it's a case of that's a similar type of thing, but at a different time. So by the time I was at Guildhall doing my postgrad, I knew exactly what I wanted to achieve. I knew where my own flaws were, I suppose, having already been broken by this previous person. So in that sense, you know, classic thing where no one could whip me harder than I could whip myself. So actually, those kinds of comments felt like a triumph of like,
right,
underdog gets a point.
Interesting that you had that experience so young and how it's informed your trajectory. And because we, you know, you hear stories all the time of sort of, this genius pianist at the age of 3 was playing Mozart and they just went to this school and everything was easy and everything, and all teachers just thought they were amazing and off they go. And that's great, but it's not very fun for everyone else necessarily to listen to. But actually, your story's quite inspiring, isn't it? Because you were told you weren't good enough and yet you went to incredible music colleges. Then you were not necessarily understood initially, or maybe you were slightly dismissed for a while, and yet you've sort of not had, like, basically you've not had like some fairy tale journey.
No.
And yet you're doing amazingly well and you get so much from it.
Thank you. Yeah, I suppose I feel like there's an element of Marmite going on in my playing, in that I still think that there are people who really rate it, which I'm very grateful for, and some people who will forever think, why is she still why is she still around playing to people, what is that? Because I think it's quite fiery and honest playing, and it can be fallible. I'm definitely not a perfect pianist, which I guess I don't know.
Sure. I mean, who really hates fiery and honest playing? God, yeah, that's rubbish.
Some people really like write notes, and I can't promise you those.
But to be honest, like, I wouldn't even notice. That's the thing. I suppose you're talking about people in the world and in the business of music, and I get that's a whole another level. But actually, even working with musical people, like people in Mischief or in Showstopper or musicals, you know, we're just like, that's great. Let alone sort of somebody who doesn't even do this kind of artsy thing for a living. You're incredible.
Thank you.
I will take that. Well, I wasn't sure whether I was going to mention this, but the listeners won't know, but we recently worked together on a non-Mischief thing. I know.
Scandal.
I know, we're so scandalous. But we worked together on the R&D of a new play by Callum Findlay called Fanny, which is directed by Katie Ann McDonough, excuse me, Katie Ann, and produced by Rebecca Gwither. And it's about Fanny Mendelssohn and the fact that she is Felix Mendelssohn's brother, or was Felix Mendelssohn's brother, and felt that she should have played and didn't get the opportunity. So I couldn't think of anyone better, you know, to play what? A woman playing honestly with fire and passion. That's what you need for a story like that.
I absolutely loved being involved in that. And I hope there's more. This sort of somehow, which is such an inspirational, that story is, in that somehow unsquashable, and somehow what I found really interesting about her was the fact that everyone around her really did acknowledge her talent. People knew, really. No one was saying you're terrible at the piano or you're a terrible composer at any point. They were just saying, nah, you're a woman, which I found all of that really interesting and very inspiring, that she was just, you couldn't ever quite get rid of her. She was always just kicking around being brilliant.
Inspiring, isn't it? Do you think now that women, like, I know this is one of those annoying questions, but I mean, it's not all roses now for women in music and composing and that world, is it?
No. It's a messy time where I think some people are trying to address that. But no, I mean, classical music in particular, is that true? No. I think all through music, it has always been, or it has been for a long time, pass the work on to the nearest person you know. And because all the men are sort of had, maybe how many years ago, been in the pubs while the women were at home, they all pass on work to each other. So apart from all the subconscious bias stuff, it's just a practical thing of, I can vouch for so and so because I've heard them play and they seem like a decent person. It's just sort of about circles of contacts, and it is getting much better in the sense that the more women you get involved, the more that changes, because all those people have different networks of people. And it's amazing how, yes, with some people we seem to not know anyone that's outside of the pool, this common pool of people, but then other people you meet and will both be fully working freelance musicians and know none of the same people somehow, because we've just been working in different groups. So it's been amazing how when people have got me involved and asked me to sort of bring a team together, that it's just been a group of people that they haven't known, and yet I've worked with quite a lot. So I find that quite interesting, because it is so much about networking. But I mean, in classical music, there is a problem with the sort of the way genius is honoured and the way sort of that tortured male character is bowed down to, in the way that women are deemed hysterical. If you get a loopy man, they must be artistic. And so there are certain tropes that probably make people think, definitely that person's got talent and, oh, they seem like a bit of a mess and chaotic and probably couldn't sit still in an orchestra. I've got a couple of, I've got so many stories, but the one that springs to mind is I found this out really recently through a particular Zoom chat with someone I hadn't met before, who was saying that she is maybe just in her 30s, a black woman. And she said that when she was at school, she started the piano when she was 16 and showed real talent. But her teacher had said, you've started too late. This career is not for you. And there's someone who was in my year at the Royal College who started the piano at sort of 15 and showed loads of talent and was brilliant and got a full scholarship to Royal College because of that short timeline of this person must be really something special, which, you know, he showed all those traits. But it's interesting how the responses to those two different characters.
Yeah, and I'm sure as well, and I cannot speak from any experience, but I'm sure there must be another layer to that if you aren't a white woman as well.
Yeah, I would say so. And yeah, there's all kinds of things of for what reason that comment might have been said, in that you could go into music and you'll be miserable, or I've got no idea. I don't know who said it, but yeah, I mean, there have been, I've known of sort of people trying to reform bits of the music industry, and sort of rather than talking about bringing the very adept black musicians in classical music to the fore, have talked about sort of maybe branching out into hip hop rather than just really, yeah, which is so missing the point. So there are lots of problems, and obviously all the race ones are right at the front at the moment, which is great. But yeah, in terms of gender, it's that same thing of, it's exactly the equivalent of colour blindness, where people are so busy saying that it's not a problem, it's just about who's best, that it sort of shuts down the conversation about gender before it's even started.
Oh no, it's all a meritocracy. It's all a meritocracy, and you're like, cool, but can we talk about it?
Oh my
god,
we know
that's what everyone intends, but
yes, I saw. I probably shouldn't be citing this. I won't say who it was, but there was a blog post by someone who actually I don't know, who said there was a time. So it was the premise was that equity is ruining the arts. And that there was a time when the muse could visit anyone. And I just thought that's such a privileged thing to say of, you know, of gender, race, the disabled community, the LGBTQ plus community having to deal with all sorts, you know, it's, if you're thinking of some women in a council house, obviously, yeah, class, poverty, all of those things come into it. In a council house with three children fighting to keep two jobs, that is, that really, is the muse that able to come and visit there? It's, yeah.
Yeah. Does she have the same opportunity for the muse to visit her?
Well, quite.
I think it's interesting as well, like, because I think people don't realise if you don't, my friend told me this really interesting analogy about privilege that was explained to him, and he found it really useful. He was like, it's like you're in a queue for the shops, right? Like maybe one of those COVID queues, and you're a few people back and you think, oh gosh, I've got ages to wait. But you'd not taken the moment to look behind you and go, oh yeah, yeah, actually there's someone who's even further back in the queue than me. So I think, oh, the muse should be able to just visit everyone. But what I'm not also admitting and sort of confronting is the fact that that guy's an hour behind me.
Yeah.
Before he even gets to where I am. And then he, what? Then the muse might be like, it's just, there
if
are
different.
If he's
not too tired and weeping. Field. Yeah.
Yeah. If he's not had to actually sacrifice all the practice in order to do a load of work, like, and get money, like, or whatever the reason, it's just, yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And I think that's what we've got to remember, that like, I'm definitely obviously extremely privileged person, like the ability to work in the arts itself is generally for most people, a privilege, and lots of people don't realize, like, maybe that they've had help where they didn't think that it was help, but it's just because they don't know that other people don't get it.
Yeah.
I'm not explaining myself very well.
No, you absolutely are. And I wonder, I love that that thing with the race where they ask people standing on a starting line, take a step forward if you've never had to lend money to your family. Have you seen this?
Yeah, take a step forward if your parents are still together.
Yeah.
Take a step forward if,
And they'll add more and more of those things. And then they start the race. And it's also really interesting to see who's left behind, because it does add in a race thing. And there's often a gender thing as well. I think the only thing I would change, if it wouldn't be damaging, because they do that particular video is using children, would be to get those people to take a step backwards. Because I think those people who are privileged feel like they're starting on the starting line.
Yeah. And
I think that's what people, that's why there is this argument of, but I've had to work for everything in my life. And yes, you have, but you haven't been at a disadvantage.
That's
it's not
it.
That you've been given
you
stuff.
It's that you've not had stuff taken away. Yeah.
Mm.
Very interesting. Before we move on, I do want to also ask you about, you've recently been on BBC Radio 3?
I have. So I was given a 3-part series. I was given free reign. It was awesome. So 3 episodes called Sounds Connected, where I pick 5 pieces and I link them up however I like. So actually, it ends up as 5 pieces, but I start from 1. I listen to it, read about it, or use my knowledge about it, and then follow one of those thought paths, and then find myself at a new piece and carry on to get myself from 1 of 5 to 5 of 5. So I've done that 3 times. Yeah, so it's been on the last 2 Sundays, and then there's another one this coming Sunday.
Wow. And you'll be able to listen again, will you?
Yes. Yeah, they're all on BBC Sounds to listen again, which I think is quite good, because I'm at quite a niche slot, shall we say, at midnight on Monday morning, essentially. So Sunday nights. So yes, it's quite a niche slot. And I've been staying up to have a listen, because I actually don't hear the final edit before it goes out. So that's quite interesting to hear. Yeah, scary.
That's quite scary. What an achievement. That's incredible.
Thank you. I've really loved doing it. And because they asked me to record a pilot, because they slightly I was recommended, I think, but they didn't know me. The people who I was dealing with didn't know me. So they asked me to record a pilot to show some level of proficiency, I think, which is fair enough. Essentially, they gave it the thumbs up, which was really freeing, in the sense that by that means that they know what they're asking for. So I'd been quite, quite honest, and I hadn't scripted it at all. So I just made notes and spoken off it. So it's quite improvised rather than reading a script. They knew what they were going to get. So it was quite nice to have that approval before going ahead of, oh, you like what I'm doing? Great, here's more of that, but maybe a bit wilder.
But there you go. You see, a thumbs up clearly can be extremely helpful.
Yeah.
Rather than a thumbs down.
Yes, I agree. I think I'm a person, yeah, I definitely respond well to thumbs up. I respond well to the sense that of I know you can do better. I don't think I do well with you're terrible, full stop. There are some times where sort of the revenge bit of me kicks in and I may go, I'll show you. But actually, if I'm in a setting where I don't get to walk off and go, I'll show you, and slam the door behind me, where it's kind of a constant setting of working with someone who thinks I'm not up to much, which thankfully doesn't happen very often. That I find very tiring. But yeah, a thumbs up and a more of the same, or we think you can achieve that level up there. Go for that. I respond quite well to that.
Me too, yeah. And I think a lot of people do. I am with you on that one. All
just
right.
Don't be horrible.
So we are
going to
move on.
Yeah.
You're so right. Don't be horrible to people. What a profound statement. like it's crazy that we have to say that, but yes, we do. But I'm going to be horrible to you now because I'm going to make you do another jingle for
another
the next section, which is
okay.
Another jingle. It's questions from the web. So I went on Twitter and I asked people to tweet in some questions for you. So it's the section is called Questions from the Web. Off you go.
Oh, okay. Questions from the web. Questions from the web. Questions, questions, questions from the web. Yeah.
Oh, I enjoyed the wind instrument there.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. Hashtag improv.
Hashtag improv. Well, there you go. So one of the questions somebody has asked, Sarah has asked a very important question. She asks, okay, how does a classically trained pianist end up working with Mischief? And I'd ask, and why are you still doing it?
The answer to that question is by accident. it's quite a wiggly road. Essentially, cutting a longish story short, I ended up playing for contemporary dance classes when I first started at university because as a teenage composer, a younger dance company had seen that I was a pianist and I used to dance quite a lot. So they'd said, oh, we could train her up to improvise for dance classes. So that's what I was doing in my first and second years. So that's where I started improvising, which ended up with Pippa Evans, who's in Showstopper. She was 2 years ahead of me at school, as it happens, and was head girl. Of course she was. And
I love her.
She's wonderful. And we bumped into each other on a weird busking project. And she, from then on, sort of started suggesting that I should come and give Showstopper a try. And I would say yes, but also sort of avoided it because it's so, at that point, I'd only really been playing classical music, even though I was really into everything else in my listening. And I wasn't a comfortable improviser. But eventually I said yes to going to her house and making up some songs. And then because she is the world's most efficient human being, when she decided that it was good enough, she sent off a load of emails while I was there and she sort of set up a couple of improv gigs for me. So that's how I got into the improv world. I eventually went along to Showstopper and they didn't fire me, basically. And that's wow, the connection to improv and then to Mischief. So I don't exactly know. I still don't know why Mischief asked me particularly to come along. That is,
I think it was because we work with loads of pianists now, particularly. But at that point, the guys who we'd worked with in Christmas couldn't come on the tour and we were looking for some more musicians. And so we asked Adam Megiddo for recommendations. So you're right. It really is a sort of recommendation business, isn't it? We all recommend our friends and people we know. And he brought you in and you're really good at it. I mean, obviously I'm not in Showstopper. I could never be in Showstopper. But for us, I don't know what you're like for them, but particularly good, I think. And you know, we're always really lucky with the musicians we have. But it's always, it feels like you're not just sort of accompanying, you're playing with us.
You're
an improviser as well.
Thank you. And as I've said to you, Charlie, many a time, I absolutely love playing with Mischief. So my answer to why I'm still there is because I want to be, and I would always come back when asked. It's so playful and fast, and it's what improv is for, in my opinion, which is making stuff that never would have happened without it being improv. So if you've seen a movie night show, most of that would not be written down on purpose. But the way stuff comes together and then the way a story develops is not how you would plan one, but because it's being made in the moment, the structure of it and the shape of it works without it having to have some very polished sort of overarching form. And I really love that about Mischief, and I love that anything is everyone's game for anything, and for trying anything, and for yes anding. So it's really freeing in terms of offering stuff. And I think it makes it really easy to be front-footed and sort of offer up in a really, like, literal sense of, how about this thing? I have no idea where it goes. Do you want it? And knowing that, because no one has, you know, that I think the more people...
No one has the answer. I've got this bit, and then you add, and then I'll add a bit, and you add a bit, and no one person is in control of it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that there's no, I don't think there should be right answers, because I'm sure you could write answers better.
Yeah. Improvise it, would you?
No. So I love the chaos of it. And I love how welcoming that vibe is. And I suppose that's what I mean about that tour feeling quite intimate, in that I did come in partway through when everything was all running and I'm a little bit face blind, so everybody looked the same to me. didn't know who anyone was. And then to go and do a show and feel safe and welcome and just be able to offer up stuff with silly sounds and watch the cause and effect of that. I suppose, I felt professionally really welcome, which made me feel socially very welcome.
Oh, well, the Flamister asks about what you find most rewarding. So clearly you sort of stated what you find rewarding about playing for an improv show, but also what do you find challenging? Is there anything that is a particular challenge when you improvise music for Mischief Movie Night, for example?
Yes. I suppose the flip side of everything I've said, if you don't feel locked in, if you're a bit too much in your head or thinking backwards, like if you've done something you don't particularly like, which I have to say, because everything is a yes in Mischief, it doesn't happen very often where I feel like, oh, there was something I should have done there and I didn't do it. That can make you lose connection, and because it's so fast and because everyone is so tightly connected and so many of those players work together so often, it can be quite hard to regain your footing. I suppose something else that's quite hard is sometimes if there isn't, like if there's a moment of not connection on stage, it's this knowledge that you have this enormous power to unite everyone with a really strong musical gesture. And that can go one of two ways. So that can be challenging of just, oh God, no, I've got nothing either. But what's really nice is that because there's two of us, you're never lonely in thinking, like it's never just you left there going, I've got nothing. It's obviously worse if two of you are sitting there going, I've got nothing, but you feel less of an idiot.
So like, it's not just me.
There's plenty that's challenging. There's not that much that would ever make me feel miserable. Purely, like, partly because of the setup.
I'm glad. And Daisy asks what the best moment has been that you've accompanied for Mischief Movie Night. Is there anything you can remember off the top of your head?
I can, but I wasn't particularly involved. It was the first time I encountered the whole rewind pause business. And I absolutely loved it. So I'm not sure this is a particular sort of musical question or answer, but definitely that finding that spot that you just want to see and holding it there is just an amazing thing. And cutaways. There was something kind of recently on the more recent tour where I can't remember exactly what was happening, but it was essentially a load of flashbacks or cutaways to give each of the characters a bit of context. And it just felt like a bit of a pat on the back for the two of us, where we did some really nerdy stuff of incorporating motifs, like character motifs of like, oh, this is your bit and that person played that thing earlier. And so we'll have a bit of a reprise of that. And now we've cut back, we're back to this character with this sound. So we were just having our own little nerd party in the corner of like sort of giving each other nods of recognition. I can't even remember who the characters were. It was almost sort of by face of like, oh, that's your bit. That is your little musical motif. Yeah, that was very satisfying.
Oh, and it brings so much to the show as well. It really, really does. And then we've got a couple more. So Stephen and Bethany both ask, do they ask similar questions? I don't know. Yeah, sort of. So Stephen asks who you would rate as the best composer of classical music and who you enjoy playing and listening to. And Bethany also asks what your favourite classical piece is. Who's your fave?
I can answer my favourite most easily. I love Debussy. I love playing Debussy. I love the layers of sounds. And so a picture is just made and it exists. So I love the challenge of taking a machine like the piano and trying to make things sound muffled or ring out or sustained, and trying to make sort of different bits of musical material sound different from each other when you're just hitting strings with hammers. And I think there's something I like about general impressionist music, where especially sort of melancholy impressionist music. So there's a piece by Ravel called Miroir. That's a sort of set of pieces called Miroir. And there's one called The Valley of the Bells. And it's just got this really, it's basically layers of bells ringing over the top of each other. So there are some fast ones and some big beefy bass bells. But there's this really heavy sense of ennui, which is sort of, I love that stuff. In terms of best composer, I really don't know, because I think it's so personal. And so with all of that, I've missed out the people that are perkier and more playful. Like staying with French, there's loads of Poulenc that is so perky. It's not all perky, but there are some people who that will speak to you better, or all of those people who are writing stuff that is, I'm upset and I want you to know, which is definitely, and it's wonderful to play sometimes, like in the way that Rachmaninoff really speaks to me when I'm in that mood. I wouldn't ever call him the best composer, because he has amazing ideas that are beautifully written, tagged together with some pointless bridges, and then next great idea. So I don't know. I don't know if I could say best composer.
Well, that's all right.
Yeah.
I'll forgive you for that. No, that was an incredible answer. Bethany also asks who you use or what you use for inspiration when you are composing.
Lots of different things. I love using the players I'm writing for. So thinking of their sounds, that's really helpful. But other than that, I mean, I try and, I was going to say look at the news, but I'm not doing that at the moment. I would kind of look anywhere. And I would try and get, even if it's a word of a title on a page, and then make some notes that reflect that, and then actually retitle it. I do that quite a lot. So I will write a title and then try and write the piece for the title, and then go, actually, that title doesn't fit anymore, and then change the title and then carry on with the piece and go backwards and forwards like that. And then the once the title's changed, that will give me new inspiration.
What's interesting about that? No, sorry, you finished.
No, I was going to say, once I've got off the blank page, things get much easier. So it's just trying to make myself write down any old nonsense that I can then change. That's the most challenging bit. So I will try anything, whether it be sort of trying to write out a drum groove across instruments and seeing which bits I like and deleting the rest, or yeah, I will do anything. But yeah, words for me really help.
Well, that's amazing, because I think you've said it, it's that you can edit. And I've heard writers talk about this, and I think it's Neil Gaiman says, you know, you can't edit a blank page.
No.
Write something down. It doesn't have to be genius. Just write it down, because that in itself will now be, well, I liked that bit and I didn't like that bit. And you start to create a little path and a little bit more structure, and then it might actually become a bit easier. But just get something down and don't be too hard on yourself.
And the thing I forget actually is that even in that, there's a bit of pressure of like, oh God, some of this has to be brilliant, so I keep it. It doesn't. You can delete all of it. It can all be awful. You just have to get something down and go, no, that's terrible. Start again. That's, you know, there's, you're not tied to it. I mean, I think that's what's really different with improv and composing, in that you start something and it's there, it exists, it happened. Whereas in composing, no one needs to know. You could write out, you know what, I'm going to write out Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, but I'm going to change four notes to random flats. And you could go, well, that was a terrible idea. Delete it. No one will know.
and nobody actually, knows.
No. And your brain might be more game to try something else and try something else. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd recommend doing whatever you can. You're welcome.
Okay, we are running. We've been chatting so much. We're running out of time slightly. But this is fine, because we're going on to the quick fire round. And also, I need you to improvise a quick fire jingle. Can you do that? 3 seconds? Yeah.
3 seconds. I've got more than that. Okay, here it comes. Quick fire.
Perfect. Okay, so I am going to ask you a bunch of questions, and you've got to try and answer them as quickly as possible.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Here
we go. Yeah. What's your favorite color?
Green.
Yeah, I knew that. If you were an animal, what would you be?
Goose.
Goose! I did not expect that, sorry. What's your ideal holiday destination?
Sunshine. Can I say that? The sun.
Sure. The sun. I would like to go to the sun, please. 2 weeks, all inclusive. If you were to describe yourself as a dessert, what would you be?
A Ferrero Rocher. Can I have one of those?
My God, they're my favourite.
Yes.
Crunchy, smooth, everything.
Yeah, soft on the inside, nutty. A bit knobbly on the outside.
And a bit nutty, mate. Is a Jaffa cake a cake or a biscuit?
It's a biscuit.
Sure. What's your favourite musical?
Jesus Christ Superstar.
No, really?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Do you know what? We were all in lockdown, but I went for a walk and I could hear, it wasn't like proper lockdown, I could hear the Jesus Christ Superstar production at the Regent's Park open air theatre. I could just hear it like on a matinee, and it filled me with so much joy to just hear some people singing and some people playing music in theatre. It was incredible. Okay, shut up, Charlie. If you were one of the 52 cards, which one would you be?
I would be the Jack of Spades.
Cute. You so would. Left or right?
Left.
Right or wrong?
Oh, right. I'm sorry.
That's okay. What is your favourite film?
Mulholland Drive.
Interesting. You're very arty. That's very cool. Do you play video games? If so, what is your favourite video game?
Yes, I play video games. I've just started Shadow of the Colossus.
Is it good?
Yes, it's quite bleak, but it's good. It's got a great
finally,
story.
Oh really? Okay, cool. Shadow of the Colossus recommendation. Yeah. And finally, who would be the best mischief person to be trapped on a desert island with?
Oh, Can I say Josh because he's a doctor?
You absolutely can, Dr. Josh.
I am smart. Yeah, Dr. Josh.
I'm a little disappointed you didn't say me, but I will. excellent. Before we wrap up, do you have any top TV recommendations or radio or maybe even commute games that you'd recommend people enjoy?
I, over these weird months, have been re-indulging in Star Trek, and there's something so, I found something so peaceful about, especially Next Generation, about the really simple way that it addresses morals. And yes, there are tangles, but it comes from just a really comforting place, and there's something about it being set in the future where it seems like they've worked through so much of the nonsense. Of just, this is how we do it now. This is the place we're coming from, which just makes me exhale a bit. So I would recommend having a watch of those either for the first time or for the nth time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ashani, for coming on. This has been really fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been lovely. And I would have you on my desert island. Of course I would.
But I get it. You need Josh first, and then you can sneak me on. Yeah. But we both need a doctor. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks for... Well, there you go. You just made me go all tongue-tied now. Wonderful. Yeah. Thanks very much for listening. I have been, and still am, Charlie Russell, talking to Ashani Perinpanayagam. Do keep an eye out for the next episode. You can follow all the latest in the mischief world on Twitter at Mischief Comedy. Thank you for listening, and keep making mischief. There we go. I will pause. Oh no, it's still recording. No!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.